This is tape two, side one of the interview with Phil Hellmuth on March 15th, 2006. You're sitting on a pier up at Menunkewa.
Well, yeah, finishing it up, you know. And I turned it in and, you know, graduated and so forth. And
when did you actually get your degree?
I think it was January of 81. December of 81, that was it. It was a winter graduation. And so, you know, wonder of wonders, somebody in the field read my thesis. And he was really hot to do this because he had all sorts of ideas. The problem with residency for tuition purposes is that state residents at state universities get a break on what they pay. In Wisconsin, and in most states, residents are charged fees only. And tuition is an added-on, large amount of money that gets charged to non-residents. And the gap between resident and non-resident was growing and growing, and it becomes much more expensive faster because of the exponential result that you get with it anyway. And so students would complain that who had come from out of state to go to school at an in-state school would complain that they're residents just like everyone else. And this became very difficult. And at one time, we had a rule, just like most of the other universities, saying that if you come here from out of state and register in an institution, you're going to be a non-resident for 4 years, no matter what. Well, the U.S. Supreme Court has struck this down and said that you can't, this was an irrebuttable presumption. You can't have irrebuttable presumption. A rebuttable presumption you can have. And so then the question became, how does a university sort out if somebody who has come from out of state and registered right away has become a resident or not? And the general test in most states is domicile. But a presumption is set up when you cross the state border that you're there for educational purposes, therefore not a resident. So how do you overcome that? And that was what my thesis was about. Every state sent me their rules, and they're all a little different, but they're all the same, basically. And it gets into the law of domicile, which is not really very interesting and probably not a place to make an academic home. If I were an academic, I would have, you know, just let it go, but it was easy to do while I was working, and I'd spent a lot of time with it. And I'd been to some meetings with people who had talked about it when it was a big issue. And when I got to it, it wasn't such a big issue, and it was good that it wasn't because I had a chance to see how things had changed and what they'd done. Well, anyway, somebody read the thesis and asked me to come down and work with them for a while, and I did that, you know, later.
And?
Houston, Michael Olivas. And I did that, and, I don't know, I taught in two or three other places. But for me, being on the Non-Resident Tuition Appeals Committee, as I was from about 1974, maybe earlier, 1971, it's in my resume.
That would be at the end.
Gave me a good sense of how this actually worked. Most universities have appeals committees. Administrative determinations are subject to review by an appeal committee of some sort or other, and that's what we have here. And a lot of universities.
1986?
No.
Oh, that's a system committee on that.
It's got to be here somewhere. Yeah, it didn't copy very well. Oh, well, yeah, here it is. It's not. So
1971 chairman,
yeah.
1985.
Till I went to UIR.
Okay.
And I sort of dropped that committee. I'd go as a spare or something like that.
That's a long time to be on a committee.
Well, there have been some committees I've been on a long time. Mm-hmm. The ones that I've been on a long time, I really enjoyed and liked.
Mm-hmm.
The credit
yes.
union board, for example, you know.
Yeah.
But that was, I liked the people on the committee. We did it in panels. You didn't see the same folks every meeting. And, you know, it's sort of a nice way to spend a day knowing that you're interacting. I mean, what you do, money's involved,
mm-hmm.
you know.
And it makes a lot of difference to the students.
A lot of difference.
Yeah.
I had students come and tell me later, they said, you know, I was so sure I lost, I never even opened the envelope. You know, who won? You know.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, but that gave me inroads all over in that area. And, but this past year I just dropped it from, you know, the registered speaker thing. Although I still get calls. I got a call on the Minnesota, the proposal to change Minnesota reciprocity, which I think is, I think it's wrong. You know, it doesn't matter how the money flows back and forth. It's a convenience for Minnesota and Wisconsin residents. We're both about the same size state. They have a different situation in Twin Cities than we have here. And I think it's healthy. Minnesota also has one with North Dakota. There are lots of these reciprocity agreements that go around. So anyway, did that and I don't know, finally I was a fully certified academic administrator. And you know, looking back, one of the questions is, did I need it or not? Maybe I didn't need it, but most of the people that were around us at the assistant dean level, some at the associate dean level, had PhDs already, and you know, it was a sign of you know, you're a fully developed professional. Now what? But that doesn't cut it with most faculty, because they all have PhDs and they're working in the field and they've demonstrated mm-hmm. beyond their PhD. The PhD is simply a stepping stone and so forth, not necessarily a goal. So it's debatable.
It's hard to be in the LMS dean's office and not have a PhD.
I think. Well, see, when I came, it wasn't, but it was. But Blair Matthews had an ED and Jack Cipperly got his, the mm-hmm. student affairs people.
Yeah.
Didn't you have it as a requirement on some PBLs or, you know,
I think it tends to be a requirement for
well,
a dean
you
title
ask
now.
For, you ask for more now.
Yeah.
I mean, you expect more.
Yeah.
People should provide that kind of thing. And I think that educational administration, people like Joe Kaufman and Bob Moser and people who'd actually been out there understood what people who were already in practice needed to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't going to make, you sit back and do elementary statistics through three or four courses and, you know,
Yes.
You know, what it takes to be a well-educated person.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about the, it's not quite on,
out of time.
On the subject, well, not quite yet, but about the deans.
I have to go at 12:15
because
that's when my...
We have to,
out.
Anyway.
Okay.
So,
all right.
Let's talk a little bit about the deans. You were hired by Leon
deans.
Epstein.
Yeah.
We
went through
then
Steve.
Then talk through about Steve
went through
Clayton.
Dave.
Okay, then
Dave.
There's Dave Cronin,
Crawford,
Don Crawford, Crawford Young, and Phil Certain.
And Phil.
So,
okay.
Can you talk a little bit about them and their styles and what it was like working for them? Dave Cronin would have been the longest.
Well, okay, I think the difference between, the clearest difference between deans was between Steve and Dave.
And Steve
was very much hands off, or at least apparently hands off, and Dave was very much hands on.
Mm-hmm.
I think Phil was very much hands-on, even though he said he wasn't. Don, I never really, I never knew what Don, you know, he was here 3 years?
Yes, I think so.
Okay, somehow I have, even though, somehow I have better memories of Steve than I do of him, or Leon. Of course, I wouldn't forget Leon because he hired me, but I never really knew what Don's game was. I never really knew why he was appointed, frankly. I mean, that wasn't what Donna Shalala was doing or trying to do, even though what she was trying to do sort of blew up, you know, and none of those folks lasted very long.
In terms of the deans that she hired?
Yeah.
She hired quite a few.
Yeah, and all of them.
And they all did.
Troiva lasted, what, a year?
I think.
You know, the only one that made it was the guy in the business school, Andy Policano.
Yes.
And Policano's now deaning someplace else, isn't he?
I don't know where he is.
Yeah, I saw him in the newspaper someplace. But, anyway, it just, her sense of management, as bright as Donna is and as nice as she is, and as well as I knew her, which was pretty well for a while, she didn't really understand the power structure of the university from the sense of how to implement change. You know, you can't do it in the dean's office.
Do you think she didn't understand it, or she didn't want to? It wasn't the way she wanted to make things happen.
Well, that's the same question, isn't it?
Well, maybe.
What she really wanted to do, she wanted to have her own influence in there, but this is a department university. It's not a dean's office university.
Yes.
It's not an administrative university. And when Eric McCready, who I still know very well and see from time to time.
Who was the
director
LVM.
Of the LVM after Millard.
Right.
Millard was the first director. Eric told me that, you know, I told him, don't leave here. You know, I mean, so you had one big show and you don't think you can repeat it. I mean, this is a career for you.
No, he
didn't want it. He went to Texas.
Okay.
They promised to build him a museum in Texas and it all blew up. Well, about a year after we left, after he left, or maybe 2 years, he went to Texas at Austin, and we had our education credit union council meetings in Austin, so we stayed with him for a few days afterwards. And I asked him how it was going, and boy, it was just terrible. And I said, what are you talking about? He said, well, if I wanted to do something at Wisconsin, I'd call Ed Young up, and I'd be in his office in 5 minutes. You know, and he'd have a fire in the fire, but we'd have a nice little chat, you know. Here, I get shunted off to somebody like Art Hovey, or they don't return the calls. And I have only seen his boss, whoever it was, whether it was a vice president or I don't really know how it fit into the structure, twice since I've been here, and it had been nearly 2 years. And I thought to myself, you know, it's sort of like William Henderson telling Javon Walker, you think it's bad here, you have absolutely no idea what it's like elsewhere, you know. And as it turned out, I mean, Eric fell into they didn't fulfill their promises. They were going to build a museum. They never did. Then they had money, and they accused him of filching it, and he says he didn't do it. He had nothing. They just set him up to get him out of there. And I thought, you know, when I see him, I say, you know, Eric, you know, what did you do there for? You know?
Yeah.
So how did I get
well,
on
if,
that?
Well, if you look back at Donna, though, you were talking about what she accomplished, and you've been at this university a long time, and you've seen a lot that's happened. Don't you think that she started some significant shifts in what's going on? Or do you not
everything,
think that
yeah, everywhere except where she wanted to.
And
most.
Where do you, what?
She wanted us to get back to basics more. And I don't think, and so it could work in student affairs, you know, or where she could get in and have an influence as a as the executive for the university, I think she did very well. But I think that getting to the department level, you know, resentment was building up against her by people that I, you know, who may be good scholars but are very poor in evaluating the rest of life. I think it was difficult for her to do that.
Oh, and, yes.
You know, am I going to say she didn't do anything? Absolutely not. She did a lot, you know, an awful lot. She gave credibility to people, you know, that didn't have it before. You know.
In the student services kinds of areas.
Well,
and the emphasis.
Academic staff. You know,
yes.
I mean, I saw this as chair of the executive committee. Yeah. And she was quite willing to work with us, you know. Whenever we had a victory, she'd show up at the meetings. She'd come, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, but I think that her greatest sense, the people that she brought here to me were people who wanted, I remember Henry Trugable. One of the things when I was chair of the executive committee was I wanted everybody on the academic staff, since they were so remote from everything, to see the regents, you know, to see deans, you know, so we'd devote a portion of every meeting to having a dean come or a regent. I mean, we learned a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Lawrence Weinstein, the regent, you know, told us, you know, I don't want to hear what the administration says about you. You come to the board. You know, you tell. I don't want this filtered information, which is mostly incorrect and perhaps just plain wrong. I mean, I was just floored at what some of these things were. Well, but, you know, your Shane Harry Peterson type of role was to just kind of do it all themselves and keep everything back. Well, Henry Trueba came and he said, you know, I just can't deal with the school. Now, here is a school, every university has a school of education. You know, I mean, it's not the geography department where there are five in the country and we're going to be top five, you know. It's a school that, you know, is repeated all over. And here we are, a top 10 school of ed and a top one or two department of ed admin. And he'd say, you know, these people all think they're so great on the faculty. I can't get them to the inner city. You know, I can't get them to teach students. You know, they just want to do their own research. And when I go to them, they blow me off. You know, now this is Donna's appointment, you know.
Yep.
And so I don't know, but I liked her a lot. You know, I think she was perhaps, every chancellor led up to her and everyone is leading from her, except David Ward is probably not a good, she picked the wrong disciple in David, in my opinion. Much as I liked him, he, you know, the aggression wasn't gone, you know. And so, but as a faculty-run institution, that's what you get. Well, we were talking about deans.
We were talking about deans, and maybe we can do a little bit more about deans today, and then then we can pick up with campus.
Well, I can tell you about deans relatively quickly. I didn't have a lot of interaction with them, you know. Most of it I prompted, you know. In the 14, 15 years Dave Cronin was here, he came up to my office half a dozen times, maybe. That's all.
Really?
Yeah. Well, he'd let me run the area. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, he didn't. I don't think Dave was terribly comfortable. He didn't deal with civil service, and you know, and he had you. You know, I mean, he didn't really need to. You know, and most of the time when he'd come, it would be for points of information. It wasn't on, you know, stuff I was doing or not doing.
Or perhaps just to ask, were you going to be able to make a contribution to the budget cutting process?
Oh, well,
I can do it.
I knew I had to do that. And
and
besides, you know, at the meetings, the weekly dean's meetings and so forth, you know, that would come out. You know, Dave would be there and tell us how, give us the red ink news, you know, all the time. But overall,
what about
that time,
those budget meetings? Not the budget meetings, the weekly meetings. Was that a Cronin invention, or did they exist before?
No, never. No, that's truly his own thing. Well, but the deanship had grown, you know. I mean, the sense of management was, you know, Bob Doremus would deal back and forth. Leon never dealt with anybody, you know, in a managerial sense.
Mm-hmm. And Steve Kleene?
I don't know about, you know. I don't know what the relationship between Steve and Ed Young was, you know. And I don't even know if Steve was his first choice. I don't know. Dave Cronin might have been. I don't know. Ask Dave. Dave will tell you. He was in the running when Steve came in. But, you know, I mean, I'm 30 years old. What do I know? You know, so. But, you know, I just knew what Dave expected and, you know, just went ahead and did it. On the other hand, when you got program management, so much of your work walks in the office, comes over your desk, is on the phone, you know, in the mail, you know. And then I got to deal with my group and you know, the Waltz and Marinas and Barb Hornicks and Maggie's and Donna's and so forth. All of whom are very productive people, you know. I didn't have any problems like there were before I came in the office. So, you know, I mean, that all sort of worked. The same thing pretty much with Don, but Don would do things and not tell me. You know, he sent around some memo, you know, and I told him, I said, well, number one, there's a union contract here and you can't do this. And Don just looked off in the, like he hadn't written it, you know, just stared off. Uh-huh. But I got along well with Don. I mean, it was fine. I think I got along with all of them very well. Uh-huh. Phil, I don't know. Phil told me that he was a big delegator. And, you know, I used to do all the stuff. I figured out all the little raises we give to classified folks that we could and so forth. And after a while, I wouldn't even tell Dave. I'd just do it, you know. Well, Phil got wind of the fact that I was sending money out and said, well, what are you doing? And, well, I've been doing this for 25 years, you know. You know, I said, well, look, you know, if you want some changes, that's fine. I mean, I don't have to do it. Mm-hmm. So while Phil always said he was a great delegator, I'm not sure just how much. And then when he gave me the opportunity to get out to UIR and to finally get a promotion after all these years, you know, I was just too happy to go.
Mm-hmm. Were you, did you feel much the effect of Crawford Young's acting interim deanship? That was between
Crawford,
Don and Crawford and Phil.
Yeah. No, I don't think so.
It had a very strong effect on the associate deans who were. It had a strong effect on another group of people.
Well, how do you mean? Maybe I can feel what you're asking me.
How do I mean? I think Joanne explained it last week. I mean, it was just, we always worked hard, mm-hmm. but it was like he was driven and the rest of the office was driven. Well, that was the time of the strategic plan. And getting through that strategic plan process with all the departments was a real stress year. Mm-hmm. It sounds like it didn't make that much difference with the research.
No, once again, I don't think he ever came to see me. He'd come up and say, yeah, he would. But it would never be anything about work. He'd say, you know, how did you guys survive with Steve? You know, I mean, I just can't imagine in 5 years, you know. And I'd say, well, you know, I mean,
he was,
there were enough of us to stay in the wake and clean it all up.
I think he was a department chair when Steve Kleeny was.
Maybe that, and now
I
you got it.
I believe that's the case.
And, okay, all right. Well, Steve had, you talk to Lee Hansen or talk to some of the other department people, and Steve wasn't buying on the merit schemes that departments had.
Right.
And
he had
that
a pitched
was,
battle with the economics department.
Right. I mean, he, yeah, okay, yeah, yeah. And Steve would do this. And, you know, and he'd say, well, I can't imagine what $100 here. You know, I mean, so, you know, it's if he had taken, had made a cartoon of you know, a Muslim or something like that. You know, I mean, it was it just passed over Steve. He couldn't see the, you know.
Yeah.
But for other deans, I don't know.
You were somewhat insulated.
Well,
from
somewhat, but you know, sort of like the Pope. I mean, you see all, you know, you hear all, you know, you just stay out of the way, you know.
Okay.
And
well,
I don't know. I think the nature of the college changed between Leon and Dave, and I think the sense of education changed, the funding changed, the fact that we were in a real competition now was much more clear. I mean, we were losing people, we couldn't pay people,
mm-hmm.
Things that weren't never became problems, and probably even in Steve's time. That Leon and Steve faced, you know, hit Cronin right real hard. We had to build our staff up. I mean, there were more things that we were getting more stuff from, mm-hmm. from Irv, you know.
And the things that you were talking about earlier today about the questioning of Bob Doremus,
mm-hmm.
That was something that always went on.
Yeah.
Now,
the
questioning from the business office or other.
Right.
Parts of campus.
Well, it just became, it wasn't even questioned anymore. Suddenly now we had reports to do, we had
mm-hmm.
stuff we had to forward, and they'd all say, well, Uptown is making us do this, you know. I mean, they weren't very, they weren't really defensive, you know. It was much too easy to pass stuff along, because they were small, too. I mean, the Chancellor's office was never really very big.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it grew. It grew, but remember, it was created when we took Milwaukee in or whatever. I mean, Fleming was the first one, and he was just chancellor, you know, and then he got a vice chancellor and a second vice chancellor,
yeah.
and so forth. So
yes, it changed. Well
what kind of questions about deans would? I mean, what are you expecting me? What are you expecting to hear from me?
No, that's fine. That's fine. Just any reflections that you have,
yeah.
on.
I liked all the deans.
Because there aren't a lot of people who've served as many different deans, LMS deans,
yeah.
as you have.
I liked all the deans. You know, I really couldn't have worked here if I didn't. But when you got program responsibilities, you know, it just happens, you know. I mean, most of my interactions had to be with our folks in our end of the hall,
mm-hmm.
you know. I mean,
okay.
Academic staff stuff, I mean, there's this whole bunch of stuff about that we haven't gotten to.
Let's talk some next time about that, and we'll stop for today.
All right.
Okay. Tape 2, side 2 of the interview with Philip J. Hellmuth. It is March 23rd, and we're going to resume our discussion at the end of the last tape, last side. We were talking about deans and what the different deans, the six different deans you served under, were like, and we were, I think, kind of ready to shift to UIR and your move to there. Is that
yeah, that's fine.
Okay.
Can you tell me how did that happen?
Well,
and what did it entail?
Most of what happened before Phil offered me.
This is Phil Certain.
Yeah, Phil Certain offered me an associate deanship at UIR. Had to do with his recruitment of Steve Bryson and the general weakness of UIR as a university office.
And now that's the University Industry...
University Industry Relations, as it was called, and it was called the University Industry Relations Project for, for maybe 25 years, and that's how it started. It never dropped the title. It was a project. And what UIR did was it made intellectual property ownership determinations. At this university, faculty, staff, and students own their own intellectual property unless it's done on a grant which reserves rights to ownership, which many of the federal agencies do. And it gets to be complicated in sorting this out. I used to do this as assistant dean in the research area from time to time, but it wouldn't come up very often because the only time it was really necessary to do it was when something had gone to WARF, our Alumni Research Foundation, and they were going to try to determine rights because this could be a patentable idea. UIR
did that happen very much in letters and science? Well, you're saying it didn't happen.
No,
very much.
But I'd get one or two of these a year.
Did it happen very much in other parts of the campus?
All the time. And in fact, I wound up at UIR doing a lot of this myself for the entire campus.
Mm-hmm. What part of campus was the most
Well, engineering and med school are the ones that do the most of this in ag and engineering.
Mm-hmm.
Are most attuned to practical applications of what basic research had produced. And it gets to be complicated, at least it looks complicated, in taking an idea to a basic research finding, turning it into an idea which may be patentable or may not be patentable, and then to actually go ahead, secure the patent, secure contractors or developers, or could it be done within the university? This all gets to be very complicated and drawn out, but in schools like engineering and med school and ag that do this all the time, it's not nearly as difficult an area as it is for a place like LNS. Now, LNS does have about 200 researchers who can be involved in this sort of thing, and the computer science department is particularly active in pursuing things. But the question there is always whether it's a copyrightable idea or whether it's patentable. And when I was at UIR from 1994 to 2000, the courts hadn't determined yet whether computer code was patentable or whether it was simply copyright. And in fact, some of the areas, the hardware would be patentable, but the software to go with it would be copyrightable. And all of this is coming down in a series of decisions, which is still going on today. So anyway, to return to going to UIR, I had for a long time wanted to be promoted to associate dean, and this didn't resonate with anybody. And even though I saw the rest of the campus, people in lesser positions in smaller colleges, being promoted, and so I just figured, well, I'm going to probably sit here the rest of my career doing this, which was okay, too. I liked South Hall. I liked the people around me. wasn't a problem, but now I'm getting into my 50s and late 50s, and eventually you're going to have to part company, and I wanted to do it in as favorable as possible financially and otherwise. So when the UIR directorship opened up, actually there was a study done, a campus study done on UIR in about 1992, and it made about a dozen recommendations.
Now, excuse me, but was Donna was gone then as chancellor?
No, Donna was still here.
Okay.
No, wait a minute. Donna was...
Well, she left in 91, 92.
She might have authorized
commissioned
the study.
Donna
Shalala was very, very good about looking at areas where she could have considerable influence. And every administrative area was one where she could have considerable influence. I mean, to the point of actually having things done. And so campus student affairs and the business offices to a certain extent. She had a real influence on and made real changes. Well, UIR has always had this, they always had this sort of ambivalence comes to mind between between its role as a university office and its relationship with Wharf as sort of a go-between. Wharf always looked down on UIR, in my opinion, because they never did anything. They couldn't patent anything. They couldn't do anything. On the other hand, if the university wouldn't have given Wharf rights to be its patent agent, Wharf would have been out there, you know, begging rather than in a position of commanding, and they did command from time to time data or results or determinations on ownership. So it was sort of in this ambivalent area. Now, one of the problems that they had, there were several, but one of them was that they couldn't get anybody to stick with it. They'd bring an associate dean in from an area for 2 years or 3 years, and the individual would come in and work hard for 6 months and then slowly drift back to his or her home. Mm-hmm.
Mostly there was somebody from engineering before.
Somebody
Steve?
From engineering. There was somebody, Bill Strang for business school. Several people, mm-hmm. you know. And because it was very difficult to get anything done. I mean, you were butting heads all the time. You had a lot of researchers. Principal investigators who really didn't want to go very far with their researches, and that is, you have to understand that to go from basic research to applied research, you need a couple of steps, and the development steps, which bring something into to practicality. Applied research actually looks at practical applications or commercial applications. In LNS, we don't do any of that, at least not to my knowledge. And so to get basic ideas out and turn them into something practical would take a lot of cajoling and so forth. Well, anyway, back to the coming over to UIR. So anyway, there had been a committee, and it had found the failings, one of which was a lack of continuous leadership from campus people and the lack of strong administrative direction at the top. And so shortly before I went out there, I think Phil Certain was on the committee that hired Steve Price to run the office. Now, Steve has an excellent reputation in technology transfer nationwide. He, in fact, had won a large suit while he was at Ohio State, $30 or $40 million on some researches that the Japanese had picked up and actually stolen and used. And after a court case, he won a large settlement, which elevated his name nationally. Steve had been with British Petroleum. He'd run a lab there. And as British Petroleum cut back, his lab survived and survived and survived every step. And I asked Steve how he did it, and he said, well, I asked my staff to every week to come in with a new idea. You know, you couldn't miss a week, because the way we do this, we have to shower them with possibilities and things that we can work on. And that's sort of the way Steve was. He looked at what was available and was always in a forward position on getting it out, either patented or even licensed without patenting. And even some of the things that UIR had rejected, he'd taken. And of course, this caused an awful lot of trouble when he landed a big contract for somebody in ag over a technology that Worf had rejected. So anyway, Steve came in and had a lot of energy and a lot of bravado, which was mostly there. Steve's a bright guy and full PhD in botany, I think, or botany biochem, a good field for technology transfer today. And he came in, and in order to make splashes, he would say things like, you may remember his, we're all going to make you all rich, and this kind of stuff.
Everybody's eyes open, because that wasn't the way.
Yes,
in LNS, that
way.
Certainly wasn't the way we talked.
So anyway, in LNS, we had never had anything to do with UIR. I don't think any of our researchers ever had anything to do with UIR. I didn't think so at the time I went out there, but I found out later that UIR had been a considerable problem for some of the people who'd actually gone to them for help, the pre-Steve Price era. And it turned some of them off to ever going there again. So anyway, I went out to UIR. Now, I had nothing in the way of technology transfer experience at all. And I knew absolutely nothing about the field, which is a bona fide field, and one that you see widely everywhere. Our counterparts in industry would be research labs, technology hunters. I actually got to meet people from SC Johnson, from General Mills, Cargill, DuPont, and the baby DuPont. And I'd go and speak at the gatherings of researchers when we would go. We'd travel from place to place, which was kind of fun.
You went out there in 94.
Yeah.
Had Steve been here a little while?
Steve had been here 6 months.
Okay. And your role, his role was director of UIR?
Yeah, he was director of UIR. Steve was long on technology, but woefully inadequate on campus policies, even worse on campus politics. He didn't really have a good sense of how to establish his office firmly and make it more of an integral part of the campus, which was what the attempt was in the first place to do.
Now, when we say out, it was in the Worf building?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which is out on the west end of
yeah,
campus.
Yeah, the Worf building. Yeah, it's out on the west end of campus. I mean, sort of inconvenient for LNS departments in some senses, but very convenient for the med school, for ag, engineering to a certain extent.
And, okay, your role when you went
the
out
office,
there was
Steve,
supposed to be?
Steve Price organized the office so that he would have a representation, sort of permanent representation, he'd hoped, from engineering, from ag, from med school, which was always a problem here because med school sort of had its own technology transfer concept or individual, which was limited to particular areas of the med school, but the med school too, and then LNS. And he wanted to have more or less permanent people there. So he brought Larry Casper, who was in engineering and engineering extension, I think, and a PhD from Honeywell in to represent Ag, and then Jane Aldrich from who he'd known in his BP lab and had run a technology startup herself into handle Ag, and then me for LNS. And we never did get anything solid with med school, but after I left, they did have some, picked up somebody permanent for med school. And that was very helpful. Now, I would sit at in my office and think about how I could motivate LNS people to bring stuff out here. So, you know, I did what just about anybody else would do. I called the people I knew very well and talked with them, met with them.
And you certainly knew the researchers
in LNS. UIR gets at that time got a fair amount of state money for industrial and economic development. And we would, at that office, decide on maybe $2 million worth or something like that of grants that we would make to researchers on campus. And then they would get the money, and hopefully we would sort of try to use this as matching money or money to get money. And at one time, since we were called on this at one time, Steve did a study that in, I think, the 1995-96 round or 96-97, for the $2 million we had gotten given out, $28 million came back in grants and acted as startup funds for development that secured other projects. So it really did quite well. And now, my problem from the LNS standpoint was, the first year I was there, we had 50-odd proposals. We had one LNS submission. Well, here I am.
Do you remember what department
proposals.
It was?
No. I don't remember. Could have been ComDiv. But I don't remember. But then, this had to change. And when I left in 1999-2000, we had maybe like 60 apps and 10 or 11 came from LNS.
And okay.
Okay, and then we had, but like all researchers who were badly in need of money, I had two or three particular pets who were always coming around. And you want to support them, okay, but you've got to be sure that money gets spread elsewhere. So here I am in a position of pushing 10 or 11 people while there are two or three of them who were there who have come up every time we've supported before and they want more. And, you know, we're not particularly interested in that.
What were you doing for them? What were the applications for? What was it, money,
well,
or was it help?
We had a, professor in zoology who had interest at Abbott Labs north of Chicago, south of Waukegan, in that area, where I'd gone several times, in some researches that he was doing. And Abbott always said that, yeah, they were very much interested, but it was still much too early and more work had to have been done here. Now, this is the perfect kind of thing for I and EDR, except we like to do state projects first. So the Aggies, for example, would have any number of ginseng proposals and, you know, stuff like that. And, I mean, actually, it was interesting.
Huh?
Well, it was interesting. But that was the sort of thing that I and EDR money would do. It would take a long time to review the proposals. There were a lot of them, and it would take a long time to discuss them and make allocations. Probably take a whole week. So that was one thing that happened, and my efforts to push LNS people into it and so forth. Now, there was one group in LNS that I didn't have any trouble with, and that was the computer science people. They were beating down my doors all the time. They wanted to take advantage of what I created as my own and take their researches themselves to software companies, startups everywhere. And they either wanted copyright authorization or they wanted to avoid WRF as much as possible, although they'd go to WRF if they had to. And their plans were always grandiose. When they go to WRF, they wouldn't want what WRF would supply. They'd want infrastructure. You know, they didn't want to have money to do things. They had that. They wanted money for a secretary. They wanted money for computer people that were they looked upon as support staff in the areas. And they'd force meetings with WRF over this. And the more aggressive ones from computer sciences would show up, and the more aggressive ones were always difficult campus characters, even though there were great researchers. And
can you mention some of the names of the people?
No.
Who were, okay, I
but
didn't
you
mean
know.
I didn't mean
you
the
know.
Ones who were difficult.
You know.
I
you
meant
know.
The ones who were particularly active in,
well,
in you coming
I had
to UIR.
Seen this. I had seen this from computer science people, as everyone else at South Hall had before. So, but this area was different, and this was more their own area. I mean, and there are, and the campus stated policy was that people own their own stuff unless there were restrictions. And in order to deal with this, I asked Ted Pinkerton, who was then an associate vice chancellor.
He was a computer sciences faculty
and
member, but had taken on campus administrative.
And I think he'd been a chair at one time, and
yes.
He probably had run the computing center for at least an acting director. Tad had done a lot of things, and he was a good friend besides. And so and that's what I had to appeal to him on and say, look, you know, how do you handle these guys in this area? And, you know, Tad said, well, I mean, they know the rules real well. You don't handle them, they handle you. And what you do is just to be sure that everything is on the up and up and they're being honest with you. And, you know, that, well, did that help or not? Probably it did. But I think that these folks, these were the kind of people that I would have really liked to have seen in other departments too, because they wanted to take things out and to do this. The LNS mantra that I would meet from time to time, I remember once going to a meeting with a geologist, a gem specialist, and she had worked up a neat profile of gems that she had turned into a computer program she used for instructional purposes. Now, I saw it. I mean, it was slick. It was neat. It had commercial value. And I went there with someone from WRF. I'll talk about this later. But she put the demonstration on, and of course he was wowed. And right away he had commercial possibilities all lined up, but not for a lot of money, just some money, because what this had would have widespread interest, but widespread was in a small ballpark. And after he left, you know, I asked her, now I knew her a little from my days in South Hall, and I asked her, I said, you know, what do you think here? And she told me, she said, you know, I'm well paid at the university. What I have, I develop for myself. My researches are important. My teaching is important. The fact that this could be used widely in high schools and sold as a program, or to go to gemnologists and go out there, doesn't mean that much to me. Yes, it would be some more money, but But I don't function by patents, you know. My research is the most important thing to me. And I got this over and over from LNS people, you know, that I don't want to develop a project beyond my initial findings, which I send to the agency and put in my final report. I want to go on to the next thing. My reputation is not made by patents and patenting things. It's made by what I produce and what I put out in the intellectual arena.
And, very interesting.
And my department expects that more than anything else. Now, if you go just a few blocks away down to engineering, you can see what the results of having done just that has done. So I would go and meet with engineering people, and they were all, you know, hot to trot on what they had, and, you know, is what's WARF going to do with this? Are they going to mishandle this? Is this going to be a problem, you know? Because I want to get what I have out fast. You know, I want to get it out there. It's got practical applications. I want it to go out fast. And I said, really? And he said, yes. And, you know, this is a problem for me. And I'd say, well, why? And because you have one of the biggest names on campus. He said, well, I may have a big name on campus, but in my department, I'm a nobody. I have sold out. I accept money from the outside. Now, I'm doing as much research as any of them, or more, you know. But do I get raises at the average anymore? No, I don't. And so the old idea that a patent is worth a publication is baloney. It isn't, mm-hmm. you know. And that's the difference between people in a practical college like engineering or ag and LNS, where basic research is what the principle is. And if you look at it, and maybe if I would have understood applied research more than I did when I was in South Hall, I might have been able to handle that differently than I did. But still, it didn't stop the campus from being one of the leaders in patentable researchers. One of the leaders. WARF is, of course, the oldest and probably a top five, certainly a top 10 research foundation for a university anywhere in the country, and that includes the ones that are done inside and outside as WARF is. And so we do have this sense at one end of the campus that this is good and we help people and we're out there, and in the other part of the campus where, no, this is an intellectual factory, you know, we have students, we do basic research, but we're not interested in selling ourselves out. And, you know, I used to get a little bit of this from Bob Doremus when I first came here, because I remember one day, you may recall John Chardy, who, the Harvard guy,
yes.
He'd have these little snippets on public radio. He'd take a word. I remember once his chuckling over having run into a woman at a party who thought an entomologist was an etymologist. And when he explained he was an etymologist, she said, oh, bugs and stuff like that. And he got a big chuckle. Bob Doremus told me that, well, you know, Chardy sold out, you know, I mean, he left the university, he does this sort of thing now,
for a lot more money.
Uh-huh. So, you got a good taste of that out there, too. I think that if I were to look at my role...
Stop.